From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In books like Arctic Dreams and Crossing Open Ground, Barry Lopez explores the wild and remote areas of the Earth and our changing relationship to the landscape. On this edition of Fresh Air, Barry Lopez on living in balance with the natural world. Also today, I speak with one of the pioneers of West Coast dance, Bella Lewitsky. Now in her 70s, Lewitsky still has her own dance company, and she's founded what will be the biggest dance performance complex in the country when it opens. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue collection of recordings by trumpeter and bandleader Shorty Rogers. And television critic David Bianculli reviews new comedy and horror on cable TV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest Barry Lopez won the 1986 American Book Award for Nonfiction for Arctic Dreams, an account of his travels in the far north over a period of 4 years. When Lopez accepted the award, he said, "Even though I appeared to write largely about the landscape and animals, what is in my gut as a writer is a concern for the fate of the country I live in and the dignity and morality of the people I live with." Lopez is also the author of the book Of Wolves and Men, a study of wolves and their powerful influence on the human imagination. The book is based on Lopez's travels through Alaska, but he actually raised 2 hybrid red wolves at his home in the Oregon woods. Although it was an extraordinary experience, he concluded that wolves don't belong living with people. All too often, the wolf's life ends tragically, or its potential for growth is smothered. Lopez has lived in the Oregon woods for 20 years. He grew up in New York City and in the San Fernando Valley. Lopez's latest book is a collection of essays chronicling his travels through North America. I asked him to read the conclusion of his essay, Gone Back into the Earth.
I had just come out of the Grand Canyon with Paul Winter, a musician, and the musicians that play with Paul, and another small group of musicians who had traveled along with us, and several friends and whatnot, and we had had a very deep emotional experience, the group of us together, and then we all went our separate ways. And I was making my last connection to get home, sitting there in the airport in San Francisco, and wondering what really was it that had happened? What is the reverberation of all of this experience that we'd had together making music in the bottom of the Grand Canyon? And what I wrote was this: I do not know, really, how we will survive without places like the inner gorge of the Grand Canyon to visit. Once in a lifetime, even, is enough to feel the stripping down, an ebb of the press of conventional time, a radical change of proportion, an unspoken respect for others that elicits keen emotional pleasure, a quick, intimate pounding of the heart. Some parts of the trip will emerge one day on an album. Others will be found in a gesture of friendship to some stranger in an airport, in a letter of outrage to a planner of dams, in a note of gratitude to a nameless face in the Park Service, in wondering at the relatives of the ubiquitous canyon wren, in the belief, passed on in whatever fashion, a photograph, a cord, a sketch, that nature can heal. The living of life, any life, involves great and private pain, much of which we share with no one. In such places as the inner gorge, the pain trails away from you. It is not so quiet there or so removed that you can hear yourself think, that you would even wish to. That comes later. You can hear your heart beat. That comes first.
Do you think that descriptions of what it's like to be, for instance, in the Grand Canyon are really good reminders for readers who are sitting at home, maybe in the city or maybe in the country, but far away from things of such natural wonder?
Well, you hope as a writer that they're good reminders. The only way I can really answer a question like that is to think about my own responsibilities or what I feel when I'm in the places that I'm really privileged to travel. I've chosen a kind of life that allows me to go to these places. And when I'm there, I think a great deal about the reader who, for reasons of timing or having to take care of children or all sorts of obligations that impinge on all our lives, can't be there. So I hope it's not just a reminder, but that in some real sense, as a writer, I I am there paying attention for the reader. In other words, I'm looking at things that are not only just of interest to me, but of interest to my what I think of as a community. So I would hope to do more than remind. I would hope that in what I see and in the way I'm able to put it together, to give the reader some sense of his or her own participation in that place, that it's not some distant geographic location to which they have no connection at all, a kind of an amusement or something at a distance, but something in which they have a personal stake.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that as the American landscape becomes more threatened, that this kind of writing becomes more important?
I do, but I think it's more than a kind of writing. What I see emerging in
yes.
in nonfiction is an attention to landscape, to the elements of landscape that we've known before in American fiction. It goes back a long ways, and we've known now in American nonfiction. But I sense a very strong and substantial interest on the part of people who before this might not really have been that much interested in the elements of natural history, because they sense in them that for 40,000 years we've been telling ourselves stories about how to live worthy lives in the world, and the metaphors that we've chosen most consistently have been the metaphors of natural history. I think it's more than just a kind of writing. I think many writers are sort of turning to look at landscape and the movement of rivers, or at developments in business and things like that, and taking landscape into consideration in a way we haven't before, in part because we sense that it's not just physically imperiled. There's something else here. There's some kind of substantial, I guess you would say, a spiritual issue at stake, I think a number of writers have begun to notice this.
One thing that emerges over and over again in your latest collection of essays, Crossing Open Ground, is your willingness to challenge sanctimony and self-righteousness and to take on moral ambiguities. And one essay I'm thinking about is about a trip that you went on sailing with biologists who were killing seals for research, for important ecological research. Why don't you describe the research they were doing?
It was necessary to unravel, if you will, the food web in this area in the Chukchi Sea along the coast of Alaska, and having done that, to see how animals related to each other there, how the food chains operated, so that the information could be used to develop a plan for oil drilling, oil exploration and drilling. So you had this irony where you had to take the lives of animals in order to protect the lives of animals.
Did you have your mind made up before joining these researchers about whether or not this was justified killing?
I never have my mind made up. Life is too unfathomable and too complicated for any individual to stand up and say that he or she has it all figured out. What I look at as my responsibility is to go into the face of things that on the surface seem wrong and horrible and deranged, and say, well, yes, of course they are, and it is heartbreaking that these animals are going to be killed, as we say, for science. But what is really going on here? If I can't determine that as a writer, if I can't expose what's really going on, then it makes it even more difficult for people who are not there to use that information to clarify these issues in a court of law or wherever it is that they wish to go. I don't think a reader comes to a writer in order to know what is right or wrong. I think the reader comes to the writer in order to learn what happened. My job is to say, I went to a place and I tried to pay attention to what was going on in all its detail, and this is what I saw, and then turn to the reader as a member of the community in which I live and say, is this what we want? Is this how we want our world to be?
You describe on this research boat that we were talking about, after the killing of seals, everybody kind of cleaning themselves off, bringing back
yes.
no traces of blood, because on the ship there would be people who
yes.
would be very offended by that. There were people who were willing to go along with the research, realizing that it was probably important and necessary,
yes.
but were very offended at the deaths, nevertheless, that were taking place. And I wonder how that decision was arrived at. You know, if that was something that the researchers were very conscious that they were doing, or is that something that you read into their actions?
No, it's something we all did. I mean, what happened was we were working off a research vessel, and some of the people on that research vessel, rumors had preceded us that these two researchers were going to be killing animals, and it was the rumors were as rumors can be, things that were stretched all out of shape, and people had images of slaughter, and I spoke to some of those people, and I realized that they had very strong feelings about animals being killed for science. And I apprised my friends that I was with of that. And after that, nobody said a thing. But we all, I mean, it was just unspoken that it would have been grossly disrespectful on our part to have left that ship and gone off in the ice and hunted and done our work and with these animals, taking stomach contents and measuring them and doing all that kind of work. And then to have come back to the ship with any trace of blood in our small boat or on our clothes would have been... it would have been inexcusably rude mm-hmm. to do that. And so that's why we... But nobody ever... None of the three of us ever said a thing about it. It's just how you've got to behave with respect toward other human beings who don't have the same beliefs that you do.
My guest is writer Barry Lopez, who's best known for his book Arctic Dreams, which won a National Book Award in 1986. He has a recent collection of essays called Crossing Open Ground in paperback. In this recent collection of essays, you also write about watching the beached whales back in 1979
yes.
off the Oregon coast. And there were so many different kinds of people who had come to see the whales. And you write that there were ethical problems that beset the scientists, mystical considerations that occupied a lot of onlookers. But for the Parks Department, they had a real practical problem. How are they going to dispose of the dead whales?
Yes.
And the solution was they burned the whales. And
yes.
you describe a little bit of what that was like. And then you say that no novelists, no historians, no moral philosophers, no Melville scholars, no painters were there. Should they have been? I mean, would you
yes.
have liked for people like that to have been invited to
Absolutely.
Witness the burning of the whales?
Absolutely.
Why?
I think that all of the momentous events of our lives should be observed closely by a wide range of people. It is no longer sufficient for us just to send representatives of law enforcement agencies and journalists to the State Department of Government or whatever it is to witness these things. I am deeply suspicious of a government that cuts off, cuts its artists, for example, its dancers and its painters, as well as its intellectuals, its scholars, off from these kinds of experience. Now, on the other hand, I'd have to say that here you have a situation where 41 sperm whales have washed up on the coast of Oregon. They are, in the beginning, they're dying, and after several days, they're all dead. There's a health hazard here. There are all sorts of practical things that have to be solved, and the police really have no choice. They've got to limit the number of people that have access to the animals because we are also fools and drunkards and irresponsible people among us who delight in torturing animals that are dying, and you've got to keep those people away, but it seems to me that we should at least think about in the context of these extraordinary events, the eruption of a volcano, the waging of war. That society ultimately benefits from a full range of minds addressing an issue like this, something that is this emotionally complicated. What I wanted to do in that story was, and it's a long piece in which I just wanted to stand very far in the background and interview the representatives of the different groups, the Park Service and the police and the scientists and, you know, the local people and whatnot, about what they thought about this. And part of what I was trying to say is that there is no best overall opinion, that if we're going to make good and sound decisions as a culture, we need to know more than just what we get in our newspapers and what we read in the police blotter and what our government officials tell us. It's not that those people are wrong, but that the message is not complete enough for us to make good decisions. I think now that you and I have talked about this a little bit, obviously something that is moving underneath our discussion is some kind of resolution with what we might call the other. When an animal like this, a huge sperm whale, washes up onto the coast of Oregon, you're face to face with a creature that lives First of all, in a completely different environment than our terrestrial environment. And part of what I wanted to know is, how do we address the other? How do we address the strangeness of life? And in my travels with Eskimos and more recently traveling in Antarctica and northern Kenya and other places, that has been very much on my mind. How is it that we present ourselves to the other? How receptive are we to the thoughts or the feelings of the other, whether the other is a sperm whale or Pintanjinjara, Aboriginal people in Australia, whoever it happens to be? How do we present ourselves? What draws me as a writer to these issues is, first of all, there is in my mind little or no separation between language and landscape. They're inextricably tied together. And language for me is a way to open up landscape and make clear in it the things that are really on the human mind. And those are the big questions. What is the relationship of the individual to God? What is the relationship of the individual to the state? What is the relationship of a man or a woman to his or her community? What are the responsibilities there? And as a writer, I find those things easiest to address in these metaphors that are my metaphors from childhood, which are natural history and anthropology and geography and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I think what I'm trying to do is the same thing writers have tried to do as far back as we go in Western history, and that is to find a way to present ourselves to the other, to that which is different from us, in such a way that we're not imposing our ideas, but proposing the best of what we have been able to develop in Western culture and offering it as a way of life. And in the same moment, creating an atmosphere in which the other can reach us, can propose to us, and in which we will listen to the other.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing, mm-hmm. your ideas, and your experiences, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Barry Lopez, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Barry Lopez is my guest. His books explore man's relationship to nature and to the animal world. Arctic Dreams won an American Book Award in 1986. His other books include Of Wolves and Men, Desert Notes, and a recent collection of essays called Crossing Open Ground. Barry, I'd like to ask you to read what I think is a very provocative paragraph from your epilogue of Arctic Dreams.
Yes. This comes in a passage in which I have been dealing with a problem that was very difficult for me, and that is trying to understand the hunting behavior of my host, these men I was traveling with from St. Lawrence Island. We were hunting walrus, and this is a kind of conclusion to some of those troubling thoughts that I had. No culture has yet solved the dilemma each has faced with the growth of a conscious mind, how to live a moral and compassionate existence when one is fully aware of the blood, the horror inherent in all life, when one finds darkness not only in one's own culture, but within oneself. If there is a stage at which an individual life becomes truly adult, it must be when one grasps the irony in its unfolding and accepts responsibility for a life lived in the midst of such paradox. One must live in the middle of contradiction, because if all contradiction were eliminated at once, life would collapse. There are simply no answers to some of the great persistent questions. You continue to live them out, making your life a worthy expression of a leaning into the light.
You know, I think that one of the things in a way you're getting at there is an argument to a simplistic notion that once ecology is restored, nature is good, people are good, mm-hmm. and things are simple and just. And your encounters with nature aren't like that at all. I mean, there are terrible paradoxes and really dark things that you encounter. And I guess what I'm interested in finding out is if your if your confrontations with the natural world have led from dark things that you recognized in yourself, or if you started to recognize those things in yourself more through your encounters with nature?
I'd be hard-pressed to answer the question, really, Terry. I think what happens, or what has happened to me, is that when I was a child, I spent a lot of time around animals and in the woods, and something I could never have articulated or even understood as a child was my sense that it was all right to feel that you fit there, that these things weren't exotic, they weren't the things of childhood, and that you dropped them and then became an adult. And as I grew older, and as I became, in a formal sense, a writer, that distance between myself as an individual and what we call the natural world, it never widened. And so, when I stood in front of something that was terrifying, or I stood in front of something that was beautiful, there was no separation in my mind about what human beings are. I recognized in the natural world the quintessence of human life. They weren't separated.
You've written that freedom from dogma gives meaning to the world's celebration of life. That,
yes,
that you don't want to impose on wolves your impression of what wolves should be like. They'll teach you what they're really like, and
yes,
you will learn from that. Were you ever attached to dogma, though, when you started writing about nature?
I would think certainly. I mean, the disabuse of dogma is part of what your whole life is about. You
mm-hmm.
know, I think part of the social function of the writer in this country, certainly, and probably in other countries as well, is to undermine that complacency that comes with dogma, with the notion that it's all been figured out. It is an enormously difficult thing to do, to lead a human life. This is a terrifically difficult thing to do, and to lead a life with any kind of grace, and the trouble that people have in their lives to strive to be worthy in their own eyes and in the eyes of their community. This is an incredibly difficult thing to do. And sooner or later you realize that this dogmatic notion that everything is black and white it just doesn't work.
You've talked about the difficulty everybody has of living with any grace.
Yes.
And you live in the woods yourself. And I was wondering if that has made it easier for you to live with that sense of grace.
I don't think so. In fact, I think it's been more troubling for me, really. I like many writers, I lived in a relatively quiet existence for a long time, and I had an intimacy with the landscape in Oregon where I live, and I came and went there on a regular basis, and I knew a great deal about the woods around my home. And then, as I was drawn away, I went up north for long periods of time to work on a book, which eventually became Arctic Dreams. And at the moment, most of the time, I'm very far away from here, in Antarctica, for example, or in northern Kenya. So I don't spend very much time at home, and that's begun to trouble me. And I've begun to wonder about exactly where I'm rooted. And I think of my life actually as somewhat less graceful than I would like it to be, because I am such an itinerant at the moment. This is a period of time that has something to do with a book and will go on for several more years, but I don't feel that I move very gracefully in the world at the moment, because I'm away from my community, I'm away from home for long periods of time.
When you're traveling, for instance, with Eskimos, as you've done a lot over the years, do they ever say to you or convey to you that you think too much, that you're too moody?
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. Not that I'm moody. I remember one time this man put his arm around my shoulder and he says to me, you're always thinking. And it wasn't a compliment. What he was saying to me was, your mind is so actively engaged on a rational and analytic plane that you miss a lot of what is going on because you're too busy thinking about it. And that man taught me to just, in a sense, put my notebook down and become fully immersed in the place. He said, Barry, you're always talking about how necessary it is to pay attention, and you've got to pay even more attention than you think if you're going to see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. When you're out on a long trip and things are getting very physically uncomfortable, you're very cold or you don't have enough food or the kind of food that you'd really like, and maybe you were wishing you were actually home, does that discomfort ever distract you from your larger goals, the ideas that you've been telling us about?
Oh,
or
yes.
Are you always able to keep in touch with the larger meaning that you're looking for?
No, I'm just as human as anyone else, and I have there's nights when the mosquitoes are tearing you apart and you can't sleep, or there are nights when it's so bloody cold you can't sleep, and you get very tired, exhausted, and there's nothing to do but go on. I mean, I've been in situations where it's so cold that everyone has thought the same thought. I hope nobody brought a thermometer, because if we knew how cold it was, it would be so depressing, it would be even more difficult to do what we're trying to do. But I guess during the day sometime, I try to, as a matter of ritual, in the same way you would keep a journal, I try to focus every day on my responsibilities, and even if I just get a few shreds out of it, to overcome the discomforts. I would also add that, these what we're talking about are really abstract notions, and the reader in the end doesn't care about, I think, these abstract notions of the other and ideas about that have certain political overtones or are about environmental problems. The reader only wants one thing. The reader wants a wonderful story. And if you can't tell the reader a wonderful story, then you're not writing. So when I'm traveling, what I'm thinking about primarily 99% of the time is the elements of a story. How can I make a story come out of this? And then if there's anything worth listening to on my mind, as just another man or woman walking down the street, if there's anything that's really worth listening to, I won't be able to get it out of the story. It'll be buried in there. And that's the magic of that wild animal that we call the language. But when I'm in a state of discomfort when I'm traveling, I'm thinking that the thing I must do above all else is pay attention to the simple particulars of daily life, the temperature, the movement of air, the color of stones, the tone of voice when you hear one man speaking Swahili and another man speaking Turkana, and how they interact with each other, and what are the smells of these particular leaves, and how hot does this sand feel on the back of your wrist, and what is the color of that mountain that disappears into the same color of sky, and where is the line of differentiation? Those are the things that I think about, because if I don't have that, if I can't tell a reader what it was like, if I can't say to the reader, this is what happened, then the rest of it is just kind of philosophical speculation that doesn't fit anywhere in a real life.
I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your thoughts with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Barry Lopez's collection of essays, Crossing Open Ground, has just been published in paperback by Vintage. Lopez is also the author of Arctic Dreams. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Frank Zappa describes his former group, the Mothers of Invention, as ugly guys with long hair and weird clothes, just what the entertainment world needed. Zappa has written a memoir, and on the next Fresh Air, we talk with him about music, censorship, and being weird. I hope you can join us.
What will you do if we let you go home? And the plastic's all melted, and so is the chrome.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bella Lewitsky helped establish modern dance in Los Angeles, but during that time, she often made ends meet by dancing in musicals. Now in her 70s, Lewitsky is still involved in dance, running her own company and organizing a new dance complex. Coming up, we meet Bella Lewitsky. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the complete Atlantic and EMI jazz recordings of Shorty Rogers. It's a new reissue of out-of-print recordings that the trumpeter and bandleader made during the late 50s. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new TV shows, a comedy special called Stephen Banks Home Entertainment Center, and the TV version of those gruesome comics from the 50s, Tales from the Crypt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. There are reports from China of sporadic shooting in Beijing, where at least three more people are said to have been killed by the military. President Bush says he will not sever ties with China, but did announce today a series of sanctions, including a freeze on military sales to the country. Among many demonstrations around the U.S. today was one at the United Nations, where singer David Peel called on both the American and Chinese governments to help end the violence.
President Bush must help the Chinese too. Free China now! The Chinese government must stop killing and free China now!
Free China!
And on Capitol Hill, members of Congress, as well as demonstrators congregating there, expressed outrage at the military assault on Chinese protesters. But as Cokie Roberts reports, the legislators are also expressing support for President Bush's response to the crisis.
The killings by the Chinese military have brought together some strange bedfellows in Congress. As hundreds of Chinese students gathered on the steps of the Capitol, they heard words of encouragement from Liberal Democrat Alan Cranston of California, followed by conservative Republican Jesse Helms of North Carolina. Helms said he would introduce contingency legislation to cut off trade with China if the atrocities continue. But for the moment, most members of Congress seem ready to hold back. Now that President Bush has decided to cut off military aid to China, many agree with California's Alan Cranston's assessment.
I support 100% the words and the deeds by the President of the United States.
The congressional leadership was briefed at the White House this afternoon and agreed it's wise to keep the American ambassador in Beijing for the time being, to keep the channels of communication and possibility of later leverage open. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Solidarity has won a massive victory in Poland's first partially free elections in more than 40 years. Although the returns aren't official yet, the ruling communist-led coalition has conceded defeat. It appears that Solidarity has won all 100 seats in the newly created Senate, a body that has no lawmaking power but can veto laws passed by the established parliament. Solidarity appears to be downplaying the election results, pointing out that more than a third of Poland's voters did not go to the polls yesterday. The trial of Christer Pettersson opened today in Stockholm. Pettersson is accused of assassinating Sweden's Prime Minister Olof Palme in 1986. Roger Wallace reports.
Swedish public prosecutors will have a tough time convincing the court that Christer Pettersson is the lone killer responsible for shooting Olof Palme. The murder weapon has still to be found, and there's virtually no other scientific evidence to implicate the accused. The case relies on a mixture of circumstantial evidence concerning Pettersson's activities the night of the crime and statements from a handful of witnesses. Pettersson, a drug addict with a long criminal record, admitted to the court that he was in central Stockholm that evening looking for narcotics, but he denied firmly any involvement in what he eloquently termed this shameful criminal act. Olof Palme's widow will be the main prosecution witness. She's the only person who got a close look at the murderer. She identified Pettersson in a lineup, but that was last December, almost 3 years after the shooting. Much will depend on Mrs. Palmer's conviction when she gives evidence next week. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Wallace in Stockholm.
Japan's new Prime Minister, Suzuki Uno, today warned that trade problems with the United States are becoming more serious every day, and he said that Japan could face both pain and hardship trying to straighten out trade relations with Washington. In his first policy speech as Prime Minister, Uno said that Japan's trade system may have to be revamped in order to rectify practices perceived as unfair. Stock prices were sharply lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 37 points to close at 2480.70. Declines led advances 3-2 on volume of 163 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Beginning in the 1940s, West Coast trumpeter Shorty Rogers made his reputation as a big band arranger for Woody Herman and Stan Kenton. Later, he also wrote and played music for movies and TV, and was seen auditioning Frank Sinatra on the drums in the film The Man with the Golden Arm. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of some 1950s small group recordings by Rogers. Kevin says these sides combine the graceful swing of the best big bands with a good soundtrack, shifting colors.
Shorty Rogers made big band records throughout the 1950s, but during a 13-month period starting in March 1955, he recorded 42 compositions using six smaller groups of 5 to 9 players. These recordings for the Atlantic label were stunning in their quality as well as quantity. Rogers wrote most of those pieces and arranged a few standards, aggressively exploring instrumental combinations and colors. There was a session with brass quartet, one with 5 trumpets, and another with various combinations of 4 saxophones. Shorty Rogers' Atlantic recordings have been hard to find over the years. Many had never been issued in the U.S. But now they've been rescued by the mail-order label Mosaic Records, which specializes in reissuing great but neglected music. I'll give you their address in a bit. Mosaic's put out a serious box set, 6 LPs or 4 CDs, with the serious title, The Complete Atlantic and EMI Jazz Recordings of Shorty Rogers. Besides those 1955-56 sessions, the box includes a dozen tracks from 1951 and 54. It's ironic that Rogers is seen as an avatar of the West Coast's waspy cool jazz. He came of age in the Bronx as Milton Rajonski, the son of East European immigrants. His New York roots help explain why his West Coast players often swung as hard as East Coast hard boppers. But just as often, Shorty Rogers' small groups typify the squeaky cleanness of the 50s West Coast sound. Not that that's bad. Their intonation is impeccable, and they play complex lines with a light touch, which is also true of Rogers' cup-muted trumpet and flugelhorn solos. At best, he has one of the most fetching instrumental conceptions in jazz. There are lots of great players on these 54 tracks, among them Rogers' early inspiration on trumpet, Harry Sweets Edison, the saxophonists Bud Shank and Art Pepper, bassists Curtis Counts and Ralph Pina, and drummer Shelly Mann. Rogers' most faithful sidekick is Jimmy Giuffre on saxes and clarinet. Giuffre really made his mark with his breathy work in the clarinet's lower register. On Chant of the Cosmos, barely sounding a note, he sounds oddly like a drummer using brushes on his snare. Thank you. That sort of minimalist reserve dovetails with Shorty Rogers' lean and economical writing. He lets the sunlight through his structures, giving them an airy, buoyant feel. That light touch, allegedly a weakness of West Coast jazz, is one of this music's most appealing characteristics. In their own quiet way, these recordings anticipate current mid-sized groups like the octets led by David Murray and John Carter that blend a big band's coloristic range with small band mobility. In that sense, Rogers is a link between two innovative contemporaries, the bigger-than-life Charles Mingus and the minimalist Thelonious Monk. The proof is in this lavishly annotated and illustrated box set, available only by mail. Mosaic Records is at 35 Melrose Place, Stamford, Connecticut, 06902. If you're feeling the economic pinch, the album The Swinging Mr. Rogers, a budget reissue on Atlantic, contains a good slice of this stuff. But be forewarned, a small taste may not be enough.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. The complete Atlantic and EMI jazz recordings of Shorty Rogers can be ordered from the Mosaic record label in Stamford, Connecticut. This is Fresh Air. Choreographer Bella Lewitsky says she eliminated the narrative from her dances because she believes dance is strongest when it's full of implication. She wants a dance to offer questions, not answers. Lewitsky is one of the pioneers of modern dance on the West Coast. Her career spans 5 decades. For 15 years, she was the star of the Los Angeles modern dance troupe founded by Lester Horton. Alvin Ailey is also an alumnus of the company. Since 1966, Lewitsky has headed her own company. Lewitsky says she works with dancers from the bones out. I asked her what that means.
I start really with alignment as the basis for my technique, which varies from what I learned from Lester in probably a few or a large number of areas. I start with a skeleton and want to make sure that it follows the physical laws of proper placement.
When you're realigning one of your dancers, what do you do? What are you doing?
I am asking that their hip not be thrust out to the back, creating a shortening of the lordosis area, nor the rib thrust far to the forward, amplifying that, that the shoulders not be pinched together but opened out, permitting an easy song-like breath through the thoracic cavity. And just asking that the skeleton be realigned and balanced so that it is as strongly functional as possible.
So it sounds like your choreography starts with therapy.
In some cases, the realignment starts with therapy, but my dance technique may begin with that, but it's the lesser aspect of it. I train to a level of strength and flexibility which should balance out so that hopefully my dancers will have an even amount of both. Also, I like simplicity of line, and I will undo, no matter how long it would take me, if I've made the mistake of hiring somebody who is highly mannered, I seldom do, I would undo that mannerism to have a look of simplicity in the body that goes out into space without interruption. That, for me, is probably the most single important look that I would want to create in a dancer, because from that, which is like a balance, a norm, a centering, you can move in endless directions.
You're one of the pioneers of West Coast dance. And, you know, a lot of people, no matter where they are in the United States, end up moving to New York because that is one of the dance and music capitals of the world.
Right.
What was behind your decision to stay in Los Angeles?
Probably the most dominant aspect of my decision to stay is that I'm a native Angelina. I respond, I think, emotionally, probably physically, and I suspect mentally, to being surrounded by desert, sea, and mountains. It's a very particular environment, and sun, and space. I find it a productive climate for me. I visited New York. I much admire the things that occur in the dance world in New York. But remember that we are not really isolated.
Have the serious arts in Los Angeles been eclipsed over the years by the entertainment industry?
Oh, without question. The movie industry was totally dominant and consumed everything. And that community had very little liking for art. Art in the sense of it's being a fine art.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever end up working in films temporarily?
That's how I earn my living.
Oh, really? What kind of work?
Dancing, always. But dancing in films, Pride and Prejudice, Anna Karenina, you know, I date back a bit.
Name some more.
And a whole set of RKO Oklahoma with Agnes DeMille, and there as her assistant, not as a dancer. And my mentor, Lester Horton, also earned his living in films. We did a whole series of films for Universal Studios. Yes, we earned our keep that way.
Do you think it was good for you to end up dancing in movies?
No. It's a way of earning a living.
But it took time away from your own dance.
Well, I was the oddity who, on a movie set, did not play cards, gossip, do my nails. I climbed behind some set and was working on a concert piece, which, incidentally, would make you a person slightly outcast from the Hollywood dancer.
You danced with Lester Horton's company from, I think it was 1937 to 1950.
You're probably right.
When you left, was it a hard decision to make? And did you ever worry that he would be offended because you were leaving?
Yes to both of those questions. We taught our classes in the theater, which meant that anyone teaching a class would have their back to the audience and facing the class. I didn't know that he was seated in the audience. And after I'd finished my class, he came up to me and said very quietly, "Bella, why are you not teaching my materials?" Well, he might as well have thrown a bucket of ice on me, because I hadn't the foggiest notion that I wasn't teaching his materials. I probably had already begun to develop a direction that was my own. That entered me into the process of, if I have done this, it's probably a time that I should be leaving.
You started your own company.
I did.
And you not only choreographed for it, you continued to dance till you were 62, I think?
Right.
That strikes me as a pretty old to keep dancing.
I have a strong body, and I never danced with my company because the age difference was incredible.
Oh.
So I danced solo parts within a company piece or did solos so that the contrast would not work as a detriment choreographically or to either the young people in my company or myself. But yes, I did dance until I was 62, and I think honorably. I mean, I was not really limping about the stage. Why? I still had a strong technique at 62.
Why was that your cutoff point? Why weren't you dancing at
63? For health reasons.
Uh-huh. You strike me as having a pretty remarkable body. And I was wondering if it's been difficult for you to accept the changes of aging, or if that hasn't been hard to accept.
Growing old is not the most wonderful thing that ever happened. I used to state that one of the best things that happens is you go in half price into the movie and you get half fare on buses when you grow to be old. There isn't a heck of a lot that's better about that. No, because you are beset by aging illnesses. All of us are.
You're in the position of working with young dancers who are gorgeous to look at, who are in fabulous physical shape. Do you ever get jealous of them?
No. No, I've had a rich and satisfying life, and this is another voyage for me. I head into what is now a last stage of my life. And it's full of information, too. It's amazing. Life's interesting for me. You learn, for instance, not to have the anxieties you had when you were younger.
Uh-huh.
Because like a Janus, you can see back and you can see forward and you are in the present. No young person has this capacity. And it's one of the gifts given to an older person.
I want to ask you about a project you're working on now, the Dance Gallery, which
right.
I think is scheduled to open in Los Angeles in 1990.
If you and I cross everything.
Now, this is going to be a space designed solely for dance performance.
Exactly.
Which is very unusual. Most dancers dance in theaters that were designed to accommodate all kinds of other performances.
Right, and what a friend of mine once dubbed purposeless facilities. And I've told her I use that expression over and over again because it doesn't work.
So what are you going to have for dance that other theaters
Sight lines which are as near perfect as we can make them, which means you line up the house directly with the stage. What we offer from the ground up is that we can head toward an ideal if we can afford it. Ample wing space, everything up off the floor that a dancer might trip over, of course a resilient floor surface, which is not usable if you have theater, if it's a shared facility with theater, because theater pounds into the floor.
Uh-huh.
A resilient floor for them is awful. And for a dancer, of course, the body is destroyed if it isn't a resilient flooring.
I wish you the best of luck with it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Choreographer Bella Lewitsky. This is Fresh Air. As you may suspect, things are very hectic right now at All Things Considered. The hosts are tied up, but I can fill you in on some of the stories they're covering. Of course, more updates from Beijing on the violent suppression of the democracy movement. And we'll hear the reactions of Hong Kong residents and take a look at how the military crackdown is affecting Hong Kong's financial markets. Also, Ted Clark reports on demonstrations in America in solidarity with the Chinese students. We'll hear reports on Iran after the death of the Ayatollah and an analysis of the returns that are coming in from yesterday's elections in Poland. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are certain things you can do on cable TV that you can't get away with on the broadcast networks. You can be racier, more violent, and do it without commercials. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of two cable programs airing this week, the premiere episode of Tales from the Crypt, and a special from a West Coast-based comic actor.
Stephen Banks' Home Entertainment Center is a one-man, one-act stage show performed before a live audience. It stars Stephen Banks, but you probably guessed that from the title. Banks plays a 33-year-old corporate flunky who retreats from his dull job and his nagging girlfriend and his hostile landlord by getting home from work, putting on his PJs, and staging an impromptu Stephen Banks show for his own enjoyment. Even though he has to write a speech for his boss within the hour, Banks doesn't cancel that night's Stephen Banks show. He's incapable of it because everything he sees or touches inspires him to fool around. He's like an adult Pee-wee Herman in his own little playhouse, or like Tom Cruise dancing before the mirror in Risky Business, but for an entire night. And while Banks is playing around, he's playing instruments, a ukulele here, a recorder there, a drum set or electric guitar over there. His landlord isn't hostile for nothing. And sometimes Stephen Banks pretends to be other guests, like Bob Dylan, who guest hosts and brings on yet another guest.
Okay, now I'd like to bring another guy out, another great friend of mine, and indeed another great songwriter. So ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome, from Belfast, Mr. Van Morrison. Thanks, Van. That was great.
As the show goes on, Banks ups the volume and ups the emotional ante. His little defeats become convincingly painful, and even his songs start to take on a tougher edge.
I said Elvis Presley died at 42. And if you take drugs and eat crap, you'll die too. Just ask Jimmy, Janice, Brian, Keith, Sid, Darby, and Jim Morrison too.
Banks's wit and his musical talent give the show force, and the fact that it proceeds for 1 hour without a break gives it momentum. If this had been on network TV, the commercial interruptions would have killed the spell. You don't have to worry, though, about Tales from the Crypt showing up on network TV. It's too bizarre, too grisly, and too warped, just like the classic EC comic books from the 50s on which it's based. The HBO series kicks off with a trilogy of episodes, each by a hot Hollywood director. Robert Zemeckis, who did Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Back to the Future, directs a segment in which Larry Drake, Benny on L.A. Law, plays an axe murderer in a Santa suit. Superman director Richard Donner directs a story about a loser who gets a gland transplant from a cat, an operation that gives him 8 extra lives. And 48 Hours director Walter Hill opens the trilogy with a story about a prison executioner who pulls the switch on the electric chair and who loves his work. Bill Sadler plays the electrician.
They say electric current's so fast the brain gets cooked just as soon as the switch is thawed. Prisoner never feels a thing. Boy, I'd hate to think that was true.
Is it bloody and violent? Sure is when it needs to be. But it's also funny and clever and imaginative and all those things that made me love and collect DC Comics when I was a kid. I sold those comics more than 20 years ago, and it's good to have them back again on video. If you're offended by Married with Children, don't go near Tales from the Crypt. Otherwise, enjoy. And in any case, check out Stephen Banks.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Stephen Banks died at 109. He was the greatest rock and roller of all time. Too bad nobody saw him in his prime.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time we meet poet and novelist Dennis Cooper, whose brutal sexual imagery is influenced by De Sade. Cooper says he intends to be disturbing, but not shocking. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers some of the other artists who are mixing country and rock and roll at the same time that Elvis was becoming big. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Good Times, the new memoir from columnist Russell Baker. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bob. You want to hear more?